On other days we fished together from our little skiff in the backwaters of the lagoons that the inundation of the Nile had created, or we laid out decoys for the wild duck. I had made a special bow for my mistress, which was suited to her strength. Of course, it was nothing like the great bow Lanata that I had designed for Tanus, but it was adequate for the waterfowl we were after. My Lady Lostries was a better marksman than most men I have watched at the archery butts, and when she loosed an arrow, it was very seldom that I was not required to plunge overside and swim out to retrieve the carcass of a duck or a goose. Whenever the king went out hawking, my mistress was invited to attend. I would walk behind her with my Saker falcons on my arm, as we skirted the edge of the papyrus beds. As soon as a heron rose with heavy wing beats from a hidden pool in the reeds, she would take one of the falcons from me and kiss its hooded head. "Fly fast and true, my beauty," she would whisper to it, and slip the rufter to unmask the fierce yellow eyes and launch the splendid little killer aloft. We would watch entranced as the falcon towered high above the quarry, and then folded those sickle wings and stooped with a speed that made the wind sing over the dappled plumage. The shock of impact carried clearly to us over a distance of 200 paces. A puff of pale blue feathers was smeared across the darker blue of the sky, and then was carried away like smoke on the river breeze. The falcon bound to its prey with hooked talons to bring it smashing to earth. My mistress shrieked in triumph and ran as fast as a boy to retrieve the bird, to lavish praise upon it and pamper it, and then to feed it the severed head of the heron. I love all creatures of the water, and the land, and the air. My mistress has the same feelings. Why is it, then, I often wonder, that both of us are so moved by these sports of the chase? I have puzzled over it without finding an answer. Perhaps it is simply that man and woman also are the earth's fiercest predator. We feel a kinship with the falcon, with his beauty and his speed. The heron and the goose were given to the falcon by the gods as his rightful prey. In the same way, man has been given dominance over all other creatures on earth. We cannot deny these instincts with which the gods have endowed us. From the earliest age, when she had first developed the strength and the stamina to stay with us, I had allowed my Lady Lostries to accompany Tanus and myself on our hunting and fishing forays. For, perhaps to mask his hatred of his rival, Lord Hurrup, my Lord Intef consented to my hunting sorties with young Tanus. Years before, Tanus and I had taken possession of a deserted fisherman's shack, which we had discovered on the fringe of the swamp below Karnak. We had made this our secret hunting lodge. It was only a short distance from the shack to the edge of the true desert. So from this comfortable base we had the options of fishing the lagoon, or of wild fowling, or of hawking that noble bird, the giant bustard, in the open desert. In the beginning, Tanus had resented the intrusion of this gawky 9-year-old girl, skinny and flat-chested as a boy, into our private world. Soon, however, he had grown accustomed to her presence, and even found it convenient to have someone to run errands for him and perform the irksome little chores around camp. Thus, little by little, Lostris had picked up the lore and the wisdom of the outdoors until she knew every fish and bird by its proper name, and could wield a harpoon or a hunting bow with equal skill. In the end, Tanus had become as proud of her as if it had been he who had invited her to join us in the first place. She had been with us in the Black Rock Hills above the river valley on the day that Tanus had hunted the cattle killer. The lion was a scarred old male with a black mane that waved like a field of corn in the wind as he walked, and a voice like the thunder of the heavens. We set my pack of hounds upon him and followed them as they bayed the lion up from the paddock beside the Nile where he had killed his last bullock. The dogs cornered him at the head of a rocky defile. The lion fixed on us as soon as we came up, and brushed the dogs aside as he charged through them. As he came grunting and roaring towards us, my mistress had stood unwavering, only a pace behind Tanus' left shoulder, with her own puny little bow at full draw. Of course it had been Tanus who had killed the beast, sending an arrow from the great bow Lanata hissing down his gaping throat, but we had both seen Lady Lostry's courage displayed in full measure. I think it was probably on that day that Tanus first became aware of his true feelings for her, while for my mistress the hunt and the chase were for ever bound up with the images and memories of her lover. She had remained ever since an avid huntress. She had learned from Tanus and myself to respect and to love the quarry, but not to burden herself with guilt when she exercised her God-given rights over the other creatures of the earth, to use them as beasts of burden, to consume them as food, or to pursue them as game. We may have dominance over the beasts, but in the same way all men and women are Pharaoh's cattle, and none may gainsay him. Promptly, on the 90th night, the king sent Aten to fetch my mistress. Because of our friendship and his own feelings for my mistress, Aten had given me ample warning before he came. I was able to make my final preparations well in advance of his arrival. For the last time I rehearsed my mistress in exactly what to say to the king and how to behave towards him. Then I applied the ointment that I had reserved for this occasion. It was not only a lubricant, but contained also the essence of a herb that I use on other patients to deaden the pain of toothache and other minor afflictions. It had the property of numbing the sensitive mucous membranes of the body. She was brave right up to the moment that Aten appeared in the doorway of her chamber, and then her courage deserted her, and she turned to me with tears brimming against her lids. I cannot go alone. I am afraid. Please come with me, Taita. She was pale beneath the make-up that I had applied so carefully, and a fit of shivering took hold of her so that her small white teeth chattered together softly. Mistress, you know that is not possible. Pharaoh has sent for you. This once I cannot help you. It was then that Aten came to her aid. Perhaps Taita could wait in the antechamber of the king's bedroom with me. After all, he is the royal physician, and his services may be needed. He suggested this in his reedy voice, and my mistress stood on tiptoe to kiss his fat cheek. "You are so kind, Aten," she whispered, and he blushed. My Lady Lostries held my hand tightly as we followed Aten through the labyrinth of passages to the king's apartments. In the antechamber she squeezed it hard, and then dropped my hand and went to the doorway to the king's chamber. She paused and looked back at me. She had never looked so lovely or so young and vulnerable. My heart was breaking, but I smiled at her to give her courage. She turned from me and stepped through the curtains. I heard the murmur of the king's voice as he greeted her, and her soft reply. Aten seated me on a stool at the low table, then without a word, set up the bear board between us. I played without attention, moving the polished round stones in the cups carved into the wooden board, and Aten won 3 quick games in succession. He had very seldom beaten me before, but I was distracted by the voices from the room beyond, although they were too low for me to catch the actual words. Then, quite clearly, I heard my mistress say, exactly as I had coached her, "Please, Your Majesty, be gentle with me. I beseech you, do not hurt me." And the appeal was so moving that even Aten coughed softly and blew his nose upon his sleeve, while it was all I could do to restrain myself from leaping to my feet and rushing through the curtain to drag her away. For a while there was silence, and then a single high, sobbing cry that rent my soul, and once again silence. Aten and I sat hunched over the bear board, no longer making any pretense at playing. I do not know how long we waited, but it must have been in the last watch of the night when I heard at last the sound of an old man's snores from beyond the curtain. Aten looked up at me and nodded. Then he rose ponderously to his feet. Before he reached the curtains, they parted, and my mistress stepped through them and came directly to where I sat. "Take me home, Taita," she whispered. Without thinking about it, I picked her up in my arms, and she hugged me around the neck, and I laid her head on my shoulder, just like she used to as a little girl. Aten took up the oil lamp and lit the way for us back to the harem. He left us at the door to my mistress's bedchamber. I laid her on the bed, and while she drowsed, I examined her gently. There was a little blood, just a smear of it on those silken thighs, but it had staunched itself. "Is there any pain, my little one?" I asked softly, and she opened her eyes and shook her head. Then, quite unexpectedly, she smiled at me. "I don't know what all the fuss was about," she murmured. "In the end, it was not much worse than using your water stool, and it didn't take much longer either." And she curled herself in a ball and fell asleep without another sound. I almost wept with relief. All my preparations and the numbing herbs I had employed had seen her through without damage to either her body or her sweet spirit. In the morning we went out hawking, as though nothing untoward had happened, and my mistress mentioned the subject only once during the day. As we picnicked on the bank of the river, she asked thoughtfully, "Will it be the same with Tunnus, do you think, Taita?" "No, mistress. You and Tunnus love each other. It will be different. It will be the most wonderful moment in your entire life," I assured her. "Yes, I know deep in my heart that is how it should be," she whispered. And involuntarily both of us looked northwards along the sweep of the Nile, towards Karnak, far below the horizon. Although I knew well where my duty towards Tunnus lay, life on the island was so idyllic, and I so much enjoyed the exclusive company of my mistress, that I delayed my departure with the excuse that she still needed me. In truth, although Pharaoh sent for her night after night, my mistress had a tough and resilient streak in her and was blessed with the instinct of survival in full measure. Very swiftly she learned how to please the king, but at the same time to remain untouched and emotionally unmoved by it. She did not need me as much as Tunnus did. Indeed, it was she who began to nag me to leave her at Elephantine and to journey downriver once again. I procrastinated until one evening, after a full day out in the field with the king, we returned late to the palace. I saw to it that my mistress was bathed and her evening meal was laid out for her before I went to my own rooms. As I entered my chamber, the delicious odour of ripe mangoes and pomegranates filled the air. In the centre of the floor stood a large closed basket, which I could tell was filled with those two favourite fruits of mine. I was not surprised to find it there, for never a day passed without gifts being sent to my mistress and me by someone seeking our favours. I wondered who it was this time, and my mouth filled with saliva, as another whiff of the fragrance filled my nostrils. I had not eaten since noon. As I lifted the woven lid and reached for the reddest and ripest of the pomegranates, the fruit spilled and rolled across the floor. There was a sharp hissing sound, and a great black ball of writhing coils and gleaming scales flopped out of the basket and lashed out at my legs. I leapt backwards, but not fast enough. The open jaws of the serpent struck the leather heel of my sandal with such force that I very nearly lost my balance. A cloud of venom was released from the curved fangs. The clear but deadly fluid drenched the skin of my ankle. But with another leap I managed to evade the second strike that followed immediately upon the first. I threw myself back against the wall in the far corner of the room. The cobra and I confronted each other across the width of the floor. Half its body was coiled upon itself, but the front portion of it was raised as high as my shoulder. Its hood was extended to display the broad black and white bands which patterned it. Like some dreadful black lily of death swaying upon its stem, it watched me with those glittering, beady eyes, and I realized that it stood between me and the only door to the chamber.